aspect of perception. I think they call this talk something to do with perceiving perceiving reality or something like that. Let's try to work out an idea together that hopefully will give us a very important insight into almost every Torah aspect or angle, and also every aspect of life and its ups and downs. And then if we can, let's try to apply it to Chanukah and see how we can take this universal idea and find it expressed in Chanukah. Let's maybe start let's start at the top. Let's try and look at the source of this idea, and then let's try to see its applications. It might sound very abstract, but let's do it that way because that's the right way to do it. Let's try and identify the subject in its root, even though it's purely abstract in its root, and then we try to feel how it has its expression, derivation in Torah, how we know that that's what it is, and how it applies itself. In the sources that talk about such things, deep abstract wisdom, there's an idea that whatever's built is always built in two phases. Anything that's built, anything that happens, always happens twice. And the way that it happens has a particular pattern, which is universal. Now, let's try to study that pattern in its abstract perfection, or in its idealized form. And then we try to understand more deeply what it means. The pattern is that Let's try and say it as close as we can to the to the official or formal sources. When anything's created, we can visualize it, or we can see it as a light shining into a darkness. That in its most rarefied sense, if you want to go up to the most abstract analogy or expression, it's not an analogy, it's actually the, if anything, everything else is an analogy, but we say that there's a light that shines into a place of darkness, then the light goes away, and then it shines again. It's called the first light. All these things have names. Then there's a second light. Each of the stages has a name. Light that shines first, it gets taken away. Certain patterns, certain reasons, then it shines again a second time, it gets taken away again. But that's the pattern. Some of the details are that the first time the light shines, as it were, it is doing it for a reason. It's creating the possibility of the second light being there. The second light, the one that is lower, the one that belongs in the lower place, could never be there if the place were not first formed. First you have to have, you know, if you wanted to put it in scientific terms, you would say that before an object can exist, there must be a space for it to occupy. In deeper terms, you'd say that before anything can exist, its possibility of existence must first be present. The space in which it will live must first be carved out. If there's no space for a thing, it cannot exist. The first light carves out the space. Again, there's a lot more detail that we need to go into now, but that's what it does. But it goes away. And the reason that it goes away is because it doesn't belong there. It only came down in order to carve out a potential, a possibility, but it goes away. In fact, it leaves something behind. What it leaves behind exactly is not so important for now. It leaves a very small residue, which is just enough to keep the place open. And then a second light comes down, and it's the light that belongs and remains there. It's a much weaker light. It's a much lower light. After all, it's the light that belongs there. It doesn't go up after that. Now, that's the idea. Absolutely clear? Let's try and understand what this means. All processes go in two stages. Of course, you realize immediately, I'm sure we don't even have to speak this out, that if we say two phases, we mean endless number of phases, because if they're two, then each of them must have two. If we say that everything has two phases, by definition, we're saying that each of those components must have two. And therefore, there really must be four. But of course, each of the four must have... So therefore, we're saying that you can trace anything that happens to the time when it happened before. And strictly speaking, if you know how to do it, you could trace that time to the time when it happened before. What do we call this in Torah? Maase Ava Siman Labani. That what happens to the fathers happens to the children. Whatever happens to the forefathers, not really happened before, it happens again. Avraham Avinu goes down to Mitzrayim, his grandchildren go down to Mitzrayim, Yaakov goes down, the sons go down, the Shvatim go down, the Jewish people go down. Each one, each generation has its ordeal and difficulty and deliverance, not in a situation or a setup or a process that exactly parallels the one that came before and will be the precursor of the one that comes after it. Now, let's try to understand this pattern and why it must be like this. The real reason, the deepest we can go, is because of Achdus Hashem. That means nothing can be a new. Everything must be repeated. It must be a repeat of something that has a deeper point of origin, and that itself must have a deeper point. Everything must ultimately come from the one version that is completely beyond all human understanding and beyond all inquiry. Everything always is linked to the point of origin of that particular process. But let's try to understand it in its manifest level as deeply as we can. And particular emphasis on how Hanukkah teaches us this idea. But the reason for this two-step process is because there must first be a very bright light that shines. But the point of the exercise is not that light. The point of the exercise is the second one, which is much more feeble and much fainter, but it's the one that justifies everything. Let's try to take some examples. I hope it'll make it plainer. Obviously, when we look at the formation of the Jewish people, we must be able to discern this pathway. Let's look at the moment or moments of formation of us as a nation. But again, you'll find the same thing in the life of every individual and every point in time. But let's focus on it for a while, just for a few moments. How does this thing manifest in the formation of the Jewish people? Let's understand it deeply there, and we'll be able to take it further. Stay with me carefully. When the Jewish people is formed, the process begins in a world of darkness, right? We are in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, exiled and enslaved. There's no light at all. Almost no light at all. It's a situation of tremendous brutality. The word Mitzrayim, you know that the word Mitzrayim, the commentaries, the Maral and others, express the fact that Mitzrayim means Meitzar Yam. Meitzar in Hebrew means a squeezing or constraining. And Yam means 50, Yud Mem. The concept is that the world comprises a dimension that can be measured, that always has 49 stages. It has 7, but each of the 7 has 7. There are always 49 stages. That's called Midah. Midah means that which can be measured. Not measurement. Why is that the right word? Because Midah is Mem Dalet Hay, which is 49. Right? See, Hebrew always teaches you what it's saying intrinsically. The world of measure, in other words, in English we would say the finite world, that which is subject to measurement, that has 49 stages. What comes beyond that is that which cannot be measured. We call it in Torah the 50th. But we don't mean 50, we mean that which is beyond counting. The Torah's way of expressing it is the 50th dimension. Example is, there are 49 days between Pesach and Shavuos. Shavuos is the 50th day. It is unmeasurable. How do we know that? The Torah says, Tisperu chamishim yom, count 50 days. Do we count the 50th? We don't do it. We count 49 days. And the 50th day, which is Shavuos, we celebrate the Yom Tov of Shavuos. We don't count anything. Why? The Torah says, count 50 days. The way we count that day is by not counting it. The way we indicate the dimension of the day is by showing that it's impossible to give it a number. 50 means that which is beyond number. So the process is a process that can be measured. Then it, the 50th is that which goes beyond number. Egypt, Mitzrayim, is that which constrains the 50th. It does not allow the infinite or the spiritual to manifest. That's where we were. Complete darkness. The 50th dimension, that completely transcendent level, that is not manifest in Mitzrayim and Egypt. What happens? In that darkness, the light shines. Can you see it? Hashem arrives, and as it were, into that dimension of darkness, and the plagues begin. The Makos, right? The plagues begin. One after another of 10 incredible revelations takes place. Now, each one more intense than the one before. You know that from the moment that the plagues began, the slavery ended. Right? There was no Exodus yet, of course. But they were not, in other words, they weren't enslaved. They were free to sit and watch this demonstration of divine revelation. Each of the Makos, each plague, was another building, another step in the building of the Gilui, the revelation that Hashem was building for his people. And in this crescendo of revelation, Gilui, the process ended with the tenth of the plagues on that incredible midnight, which the Psukim indicate was a night that really looked like a day. A night that was light as the day. And as the light had come into the darkness so intensely that even the night looked like a day. Yom HaShem, lo yom v'lo yilayla. It wasn't day and it wasn't night. I mean, something even higher than day. But anyway, the light comes in. The firstborn are destroyed. Of course, that's parallel exactly to Hashem's firstborn being born, which is us. We go out of Mitzrayim. 7 days later, we reach the sea which splits. And that moment is the highest revelation that any human being had ever experienced. There it says that the lowliest of the Jewish people saw more than the highest of the prophets ever saw subsequently. Right? It was 50 times as much as what happened in Egypt, or 200 times, or 250 times as much. Many, many, many times greater than the potency and the voltage and the revelation that had taken place in Mitzrayim. That's what happened at the sea. So what is the pattern? The pattern is situation of darkness. The light shines very intensely, and it builds up to a peak, and then we were put in the desert and told, if you want to get to Sinai, you have to walk through the desert. Now, let's understand this carefully. You know that a desert means, again, to our insensitive ears, it means what it meant to you when you were 6 years old learning in Cheder, which is that a desert is a place of sand without any water, it's dangerous. You have to understand the Torah is always talking at a much deeper level. Of course it was a place of sand without water. But desert in Torah always means a place that is a place of intense death energy. If it means a place that's hot and dangerous without water, then in the spiritual dimension that's what it means. The Jewish people were required to move through the dimension. You know, how intense is the ordeal of the desert? How much energy of negativity and death is concentrated there? Think for a moment. Recall for a moment that in the years we spent in the desert, not those days that took us to Sinai, but due to whatever it was that we failed and we were required to wander in that desert for decades. During the years that we wandered in the desert, you'll remember that we were faced with 10 ordeals and we failed all of them. Do you know what the nature of those 10 ordeals was? Those 10 ordeals were the challenge and the opportunity to conquer all 10 dimensions of evil. In other words, the desert is the place where all evil, the cosmic range of evil is concentrated, and the Jewish people were given the opportunity to kill all of that. In other words, the journey was intended to be from the lowest point on earth, which is Egypt, to the highest point on earth, which is Eretz Israel, going through all dimensions of the world's reality and detoxifying, decontaminating, in other words, wiping out all of the world's evil so that the journey would end with utter perfection and be no more evil left. And of course the battle was so tremendous and so great, in fact, the enemy was so enormous, the cosmic power of it, we failed all of them. We failed all 10. You know, what you have to understand is that the plagues that took place in Egypt were also 10. And the ordeals we had in the desert were also 10. There's not everything in the Torah, every 10 is always parallel. Always. Everything. Every 3 is parallel to every 3, every 7, every... If it's 10 plagues there and 10 ordeals there, they parallel each other. You know what the parallel is? Listen well. In Egypt, in Mitzrayim, Hashem came in and said, look, you sit back and watch how it's done. I'm going to knock out all 10 dimensions of evil that the Egyptians have perpetrated and contaminated and damaged. I'm going to show you how to purify something in 10 stages. You're going to be left in the desert yourself after this, and that's when you're going to have to do it. And that's exactly the pattern. The first night is when it happens for free. You sit back and watch. And watch well and take note and learn. And then the lesson's over, and then you have to do it yourself, and that's when the danger begins. That was the message. You know, you have to understand that, again, it's an endless subject, but Maral explains that, you know, that the 10 sayings, the 10 ordeals, the 10 plagues in Egypt were parallel to the 10 sayings of creation. Again, it's obvious that the 10 parallel each other exactly. The 10 ordeals in the desert, can you see that? Where had the 10 difficulties that we went through in the desert, where had we gone through them once before? Ma'aseh Avasim and Labanim. Didn't Avraham Avinu have to go through 10 ordeals? What was the 10th of his? Firstborn, wasn't it? Sacrificing his firstborn. That's parallel to the night of destruction of the firstborn. You have to work it out in detail. Always exactly parallel. The Maral says that all 10 plagues in Egypt were an exact repetition of the 10 sayings of creation, but in reverse order. Why? The world is created in 10 dimensions, right? Without going into the mystical details. The world is created in 10 layers, 10 levels. How do you do a thing like that? You start with an infinitely dimensionless center, and you build a layer around that, and around that, until finally you have 10 layers that are constructed, right? What's the beginning? Bereshis. Bereshis is the moment of firstness where the thing begins. Then you have around that, let there be light, and so forth, until you have 10 layers. Says the Maral, when you want to decontaminate something, you must peel away the layers from the outside in. When you build, you start from the inside and you build until you have your thing constructed. But when you purify something, you must start on the outside and peel away the layers till you get back to the pure center. Right? And that's why the plagues went in reverse order. What was the first of the sayings of creation? In the beginning, the moment of firstness. What was the tenth of the plagues? Destruction of the firstborn. The moment of firstness. What was the second of the sayings of creation? Let there be light. What was the second last of the plagues? Darkness. The Maral works out all 10 of them showing you, right, this is simple cheder material, right, this is not, you need to come to a talk at Kinloss with this, I mean, I'm sure this is the way you teach your cheder children, don't you? It's not fancy footwork here, this is just basic pshat in Torah, right? This is how it works. Now, you see from this that what was happening in Egypt was that what the Egyptians had done, which was they had damaged the fabric of their society, they had built a culture that was so immoral, that they had damaged and soiled and sullied all 10 levels of the creation within their society. So the plagues came to cure and purify all of that. But in the desert, we didn't face 10 levels of an individual society or culture. We faced all 10 root dimensions of evil themselves. That's how immensely negative and threatening dangerous the depth of the desert was. That's another subject in its own right. But let's extract from that only one thing. Let's identify the process. What is it? First of all, Hashem appears, right? And you get uplifted. Do you do any work for that? No. We just suddenly found that the slavery was, in fact, the Ari says, that had it gone on for 1 second longer, we would have disappeared. Had the slavery in Egypt continued any longer, we would have disappeared. Sunk in Egyptian, completely annihilated. That's why Hashem took us out at the instant that he did, because we couldn't have, no, at the lowest point imaginable. At that moment, because we were about to disappear, Hashem saved us. Did we save ourselves? No. We sat back and Hashem arrived. One plague after another, uplifted, until finally the 10th one, an incredible blaze of miracles when Hashem himself appears, not through any agency. And if you think that's something, 7 days later at the sea, that pales into insignificance. You're talking about an incredible moment of it, and then you get dropped in the desert. You want to get to Sinai? Now you walk through the desert. And only if you survive that, then you get to Sinai, which makes everything else pale into total insignificance. What's the pathway? Let's just understand this. This is the pathway of all of life. If you don't understand this, there's no hope. No hope. No hope for coping, no hope for relationships, there's no hope for anything. Especially in this generation, which doesn't know the secret. Life is like this. First, Hashem does it for you for free. You don't deserve it. You didn't work for it. You didn't earn it. But he does it for you for free. And just when you think it's going to last forever, pulls it out from under you, and that's when you feel the cruel hand of despair, potential depression, abandonment, betrayal. But that's where you become who you have to become. You don't become who you have to become while he's doing it for you for free. But he has to do it for you for free first, otherwise you wouldn't know what's expected. Right? Let's try and get this clear. You know, Pesach is Nisan, right? Nisan Iyar Sivan takes you to Shavuos. Nisan is Nisim, it's miracles, you can't miss it. It's miraculous, you don't have to do anything. Then comes Sefirot HaOmer, which is very dangerous. It's a very, very difficult time. Historically, it's been a very tragic time for the Jewish people. Can you see what's happening? There's the miraculous revelation, and then you enter the danger. You know that Nisan is miracles. Which is the mazal of Nisan? What is the zodiac of Nisan? The sheep. The sheep. It's a passive animal that gets led passively. Iyar, when you spend time in the desert, what is the mazal of that month? The ox, the bull. That's an animal that has to develop its own willful strength. What's the mazal of Sivan? Toomim, Gemini, twins. See what's happening? First it gets done for you entirely. Then you have to entirely do it yourself. And then there's the harmony of perfect balance between the two. That's what it is. That Gemini is Toomim, twins, is Sivan. That's Hashem and us. It's the written and the oral law. It's Moshe and Aaron. It's the two luchos, etc., etc., etc. It's the perfect harmony. Not absolute equality and harmony. Nisan Hashem does it all. We just get carried along as passengers. Iyar, he steps back and we have to fight it out in the desert. Sivan, we come together in perfect harmony, perfect partnership. But the only reason we could become his partner is if he first showed you how to do it and then he stopped showing you. You know, when the father teaches his child to walk, picks a little child up, holds his hands, and he lifts the little child to his feet, and the child takes his first step. And that's an absolutely ecstatic moment. The child's walking. But not only is he walking, he can't fall. What a moment. He's standing on his feet for the first time, and he's actually walking. But he's walking with the security of being impossible to fall. It's a remarkable moment. And just when the child feels that surge of exhilaration, Abba, let's go. You know what? Abba, let's go. Because that's where he learns how to walk. But you know what he feels when Abba, let's go? Terrible. He feels the danger. He's been lured into the situation there's no way out of now. And who let him down? The one who put him into it. You know, the betrayal that feels like. Understand what's happening? But that's when he learns to walk. And then when he realizes what's happened, then he rushes into his father's arms. And then he realizes only then that in the moment of his father's abandonment was manifest a greater love than when his father held him. That's not how it feels when you're going through it. That is the story of the whole of life. There's a first light that shines. It doesn't belong here. The light's going to go away. It does not belong here. It's a very, very strong light. It's a pure gift. If it doesn't belong, it's not going to last. It just makes it possible that the second light shall shine. Then it goes away. Then the second light shines in. That's the real one. That's nothing compared to the first one, but it's far more. Let's try to understand this. See, this generation thinks that it's all the free gift of the free lunch. So when it goes away, they feel terrible. They've been let down, and you know, why me? And it's all unfair. And it's like, that's real life. The first thing is not real. The first is a quick fix. That's why they're into drugs and other quick fixes. They want it artificially and instantly and now. And as soon as it lets them down, they want another quick fix. That's what happens. So they get married again. And they get married again. They get married again. California, they don't bother to get married now. Why be let down? You know, it's going to let you down anyway, Simon. But that's exactly the... Let's try and understand this. You see, the pattern is that first you have to be uplifted. You have to be shown, and you have to be convinced and inspired. You have to be shown what it could be to be there. The only way you can do that is you pick the child up by his hands. It's completely artificial, it's meaningless, but it's necessary. And then you have to abandon him. That's the only way to do it. Both phases are essential, of course. And it's only the combination of both phases that leads to the perfection. Let's try and take a few examples and see if we can understand this. By now, I'm sure your minds are racing ahead of me. I'm sure you've raced through the whole of Chumash and Tanakh, and you've identified the fact that this happens all over, doesn't it? Doesn't it? What are a few examples? Bais Rishon, Bais Sheni. It's two Batei Mikdash. The temple stands once and it stands again. The second, nothing compared to the first. The second Beis HaMikdash had no Shechina, you know that? There was no Shechina in the Beis HaMikdash. People, the Gemara says that people who saw the second temple who had been alive during the first one wept when they saw the second. It was far more beautiful physically. It was twice the size and far more beautiful, but it was empty compared to the first. But that's when Hanukkah took place. in that contamination. Let's understand. We'll get there, Mr. Shem. Let's work through a few other examples and try to apply to Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a very small light, but it's the real light. Let's try and work through a few examples. Again, I'll leave you to do your own homework and think about it. Pasushim by Shani. Yes, what else? Luchos Rishonos and Shneis. What happened to the first tablets? Weren't they incredible? The first Luchos that Moshe Rabbeinu got, did he have to do them himself? He was given them, a miraculous gift. Unbelievable. The writing was written all the way through, completely miraculous. The Maral says it had the written and the oral law all on one absolute book. But they broke. They didn't belong here. They broke. And Hashem said to Moshe, Kerch that you broke them. That's exactly what was needed. And the second ones had to be carved out by a human hand. But they're the ones that lost it. And so it goes. So it goes. It's first a level of perfection in Gan Eden, and then there's an exile, and then there's the rest of history. Not pretty. Not a picnic. There's no resemblance to the one that came before. And so it goes. Every event in Torah is Maase Avos Simon Labanim. First the fathers go through it, and they show how it's to be done, and then the children struggle through it. That's how it has to be. Let's take a few examples and see if we can see how universal this idea is, if I haven't managed to convince you already. You know, if you look at life, you'll see that life fits into two phases. Now, if we can just make it a little bit more sophisticated, you know, we said that if this idea is true, it must apply everywhere, correct? So can you see that if you take a lifetime, you must be able to divide it into two phases, and you must be able to identify these two phases as being synonymous with those two. But then if you take a life and you cut a smaller piece out of it, you should also be able to see the two phases there, shouldn't you? Because of everything. So you could take any piece of a lifetime, no matter how big or small, and you'll be able to see that it has two phases. Let's try and do that. You know, the body's built that way. You know that your body's built, the way your nervous system is built, is such that you can only have a sensation for a very brief time, and it gets taken away. If you feel something, your senses only feel it initially. Then there's an accommodation and you can't feel it anymore. You have to touch it again. If you smell something, you're only aware of it as it impinges on your consciousness initially. After you get used to it, you can't smell it at all. If you hear a sound, you only hear it initially. It's remarkable. You think it's an accident? You only hear it initially. After a while, if it stops, you're amazed to realize that it was going all the time. You didn't even hear it. The body's built in such a way that it's only sensitive to the initial burst of activity, and then it fades away into insensitivity. Let's take a lifetime and cut it and see that. So, I mean, again, it should be obvious. Take a life, take a human, the expanse of a human life. Let's take a human being before creation, the soul before it's put into a body, and then the soul in a body. Well, can you see the two phases? The neshama, before it's put into a body, is part of Hashem's, it's in Hashem's world. Can you imagine anything more supercharged than that? And then it gets put into the earthiness of a body. Ooh, that's a second phase. That's a second phase. In fact, it's so painful that the neshama refuses to go in. The neshama weeps and cries, and the midrashim say that when Hashem says to the neshama, you're going to go into a body, it starts objecting and crying in terror and misery. Hashem has to trick it into going, you know that? Hashem has to trick it into going to a body. He has to lock it into a body so that it feels what it is to be alive. The midrashim say that Hashem says to the neshama, you're going into a body. The neshama starts weeping hysterically. Hashem says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put you in a body only for 1 second and then you can choose. So the neshama says, fine. So Hashem puts the neshama into a body for 1 second and the neshama says, don't kill me! And that's how you get born. But it doesn't want to go there. Because that's the second phase, that's painful. But that's where you become you. You're not you in the first phase, you're just the potential. It's only when you come down here and you go through all the gruesome difficulties of this thing, then you become, then there's a rushing back into your father's arms at the end. And then you realize it was not abandonment and difficulty, it was what made you you. And you can't realize it while you're going through it. Make sense? Let's cut it a bit more finely and see if we can identify the same pattern. Let's leave out the world before this. Let's take the formation when a child is in the phase of pregnancy, and then when it's born. What does the Gemara say about a child that's unborn? Hashem teaches it the whole Torah. Can you see this? What an uplift. What Hashem appearing in Mitzrayim. Who could give me like those months when I learned Torah? The Malach comes and teaches the child the whole Torah. He's a ner doluk al roshay. There's a light lit above his head. But sefer boim is sefer olam bat sefer. He sees with this light from one end of the world to the other. You know, that's what the Gemara says. And he learns the whole Torah. Actually, some commentaries say that what the child learns, he learns his own chelek in Torah. He learns the whole Torah as it applies to him and his life, or her life. Exactly what this child will need to know forever. Right? That means this little baby, while he's unborn, knows everything there is to know about the world. He knows, it's indescribable what this child knows. Misofa olam vatsofa, do you know what that means? And where does he see it? In his own existence. You know, it says, Ner doluk al roshay. You know what that means? There's a light shining above his head. There's a light, you know what it means? There's a light shining on his head. That's a little strange, isn't it? If you want to illuminate a scene, you don't shine the light on you. I mean, if you've got a very big ego, I suppose you might. But you don't shine the light on you. If you want to see a scene, you shine the light on the scene. Why is the light shining on his head? That's where he sees it. That's where he sees it. He sees himself. He sees the whole world within him. Imagine that. And then what happens when he's born? Ba malach v'seisro al piv. The malach strikes him, and the child forgets everything, and he's born a simple, unlearned baby who knows nothing. First of all, the first obvious question is, why would Hashem teach a child the whole Torah if he's going to make him forget it? I mean, well, what's going on? The answer is, the child doesn't forget. What happens is that incredible wisdom, that unbelievable expanse, and that is driven deep into the subconscious. The child's born with deep in his subconscious. He has all that wisdom. It's just out of reach. Why? So that swirling around just beneath the surface is an awareness and an intimation that it's almost there. How many times in your life haven't you felt that just out of reach, it's there? Haven't you ever had... How many times have you felt in your life you've been here before? You know why? You have been here before. And that's how you... When you hear something true, you hear a Torah idea that really resonates and it strikes a chord. How do you know that it's true? You know how you know? Because it's inside already and it's setting up a resonance with that which is... In fact, that's how you know it's true. If you never had this in you, if you're like they teach you in the secular world, that you're a piece of blotting paper, biological protoplasm, right? Completely unprogrammed, yes? Now you emerge like this little gorilla that they say you are, and you start learning things. So as things go in, they go in. Why do you respond? They're wrong. You know why you respond? Because things aren't going in. Things that are going in are bringing out that which... You know, when people learn Torah, they say a chiddush. Somebody learns Torah. You see, man sitting there by spirit is learning Torah. Suddenly has an incredible original insight. Amazing insight. Writes it down. A few minutes later, it's a good day. Another insight. Writes it down. And if it's a big time in Chacham, he'll eventually come out with a book, a sefer. He'll publish the sefer of his own chiddushim. What a chutzpah. What a chutzpah. You're writing Torah? It's Hashem's Torah. It's not yours. How can you make up Torah? What is that? But you know why you can do it. You're not making it up. You're just bringing it out. That's all. In the making it up. What a chutzpah to make up your own Torah. You can't make up Torah. But you're not making it up. It's deep within. And you know what? Everybody writes chiddushim that is his own Torah. You know why? Because that's yours. It's your chelek. It's deep within you. And what happens when you learn, what's happening when you learn Torah, is it's resonating. It's picking up the sparks of that which is there already, and it's bringing it out. This is one of the incredibly rare examples where even in English they know this. Even in English. You know what the word? The word in English they use is education. Do you know what that means in Latin? A duco in Latin means to lead out, to draw out. Again, they don't know this. When they use the word education, they think they mean indoctrination. Indoctrination means to put the doctrine in. But whoever coined the word education originally, they knew what they were talking about, because you're not putting the doctrine in, you're leading it out. That's what you're doing, you really are. Real education isn't to stuff information in. It's to resonate, so it's to get the process going so that the wisdom comes out. That's what it is. And that's why when you grow and develop, you have the motivation to grow and develop. You know why? Because deep inside, swirling beneath the surface, is this incredible sense of inspiration, this incredible sense of things being larger than they appear to be, and you know it's like that. And that's, otherwise you wouldn't be motivated. If Hashem didn't do that when you were an unborn child, you'd be born like a little piece of blotting paper. You'd be born a little neutral gorilla. And you'd go through life swinging in the trees. You'd have no inspiration, no intimation of that which is deeper. So he doesn't do that. First, he gives you the phase of inspiration when he lifts you up and holds your hand. That's when you're unborn. And then at the critical moment, when you're enjoying the most incredible and idyllic existence, me yitneni kiyocha iken, who give me like those months? Blow, it takes it away. But that's why you're able to go through life and able to achieve something, because you were there once. You were there once before. And again, if you cut it a little more finely, can we cut it more finely? Let's forget about the baby. Take it from birth on. Well, there's childhood and adulthood. Can you see that childhood is a time of incredible inspiration? Can you see that? Children and teenagers have an unbelievably expanded sense of reality. They've got no sense of limitations. You ask a 5-year-old what he wants to be. He'll tell you the most bizarre combination of impossibilities, doesn't bother him. Because he's going to, you know, honestly believes that he's going to be the world's greatest everything. And teenagers have that disease worse. Especially in Western society. You speak to an 18-year-old male. Women don't have this problem. Women are creatures of the second phase. Women are creatures who get stuck in and they start building. Men are creatures of the first phase. See, men are creatures of the artificial illumination stage. That's what a man is. So he's always hanging around looking for another quick fix and a quick thrill. And that we'll have to talk about another time. Don't like to spend too much time on it because it's almost certainly a misprint anyway. But the point is that that's what it is. There's male and female. See, men are creatures. Men are like children. In case you hadn't noticed. Not in Torah society, of course, where, you know, we work on ourselves and we become mature rapidly. But in secular, undeveloped terms, men are children. And children are always looking for the experience of newness. Somebody showed me a book written by an Eastern mystic, non-Jewish, Eastern mystic, translated into English. And a line caught my eye. Very interesting. He said, a woman is a woman, but a man is a child always. You look around in broader society, you'll see men of 50, they're playing with the same toys that they were playing with when they were 15. It's a bit bigger and more expensive, but basically the same. Why? Women don't do that. Women don't do that. But there's the first phase and there's the second phase, and again, it needs a lot more discussion. But the first phase is the phase. And children are creatures of the first phase. They are have expanded sense of consciousness. You speak to an 18-year-old, and you ask him, if you interview carefully a modern male 18-year-old in the secular society, you'll see that he honestly believes he is the world's greatest, you name it, intellect, sportsman. What happens when he's 28 and 38 and 48 and 58? And he's not the world's greatest anything? There's only two consequences, only two options. Either depression, they are morbidly depressed, or they keep right on fantasizing that they are the world's greatest everything. They just haven't had time to do it yet, but they'll get there. Yeah, it's one of those responses. But yeah, that's not our subject for tonight. The point is that there's this incredible sense of expanded consciousness, right? That everything's possible. There's no limitation. But life closes in on you. Life closes in. When you get older, that sense of inspiration and expansion is not there anymore. When you're 28 and 38, and somebody says, Rabbi, something's wrong with me. I say, what's wrong with you? He says, I've died inside. So what do you mean you've died? He says, when I was 18, life was larger than life. I could cry easily. I laughed easily. My emotions were so rich. I was overflowing with emotion and richness of life. And now, flat. There's nothing wrong with you. That's the way you're designed to be. When you're young, you're given an overdose of inspiration so that you can feel what you could be. It's an illusion and it's real. It's an illusion because it's been given for free, it's going to get taken away. It's real in the sense that the father doesn't show the child something he can't do. If he puts him on his feet and shows him how to walk, he can do that. And as children start growing, you see that they start slowly picking up the sense of limitation. And it creeps into their mind little by little. I was walking to shul with my young son, 6 years old. And as we're walking along, he gets very quiet for a couple of minutes. So also very unusual. We usually take his temperature if he does that. And after a couple of minutes silence, he says to me, Abba, the look of concern on his face, I'm not sure if I'm going to marry Debbie or Frida. Because they are two little neighbors, you see. So I say, Then he looks really worried and he says to me, but Abba, whichever one I marry, the other one's going to be so upset. Fine. As we get to shul, walking up the steps, he stops absolutely cold and he looks at me with a real worry and he says to me, but Abba, whoever I marry, all the others are going to be so upset. You see, for the first time in his little life, he's realizing things close down. You know, there's certain options. You don't have it all. But children don't realize that naturally. See, Hashem gives childhood an incredible dose of light. The first light shines very bright. Children have a sense that the world can be perfect. Children don't have the sense of responsibility and limitations and the limitations of finance and of practicality and of health, and they don't have that. They just have an incredible illusion of potential, and that's what it is. But it's not real. It is real, but it's not real. That's how it goes. And all experiences are like that. The first time you meet somebody, a new relationship, or in the Balchuba world, very often you see people who become more Jewishly observant and knowledgeable. People who start out in a more secular mode, Baruch Hashem these days have hundreds and thousands of young people going through that process. You see that this person, when they start out, it's unbelievable. They'll tell you that they started this Jewish learning, they were flying. Every line they learned, they met some rabbi or some teacher, everything he said, everything they learned was incredibly inspiring. And a couple of years later, it's hard work. Very hard work. I remember a certain young man standing next to a certain Rosh Yeshiva at a certain, this is a chasana in Yerushalayim. And he was standing next to this Rosh Yeshiva. He himself had gone through much of this process, and it so happens that the Rosh Yeshiva he was standing next to had also gone through this 30 years before. One of the very earliest, 30 years before, this man was. And he himself today is acknowledged Rosh Kollel of a big yeshiva. He said to the young man, "How's it going in yeshiva?" The young man said, "You know, Rabbi Sansa," I said, "it's so hard." He said, "When I started out, everything was so incredibly inspiring. Every piece of Gemara I learned was absolutely amazing. And now I sit there and I sweat and I strain. Hour after hour, it becomes more and more difficult." The older man looked down at him and he said, "I see you're in phase two." Oh, then it became meaningful. They understood that's the way it has to be. See, but it's that sweating and struggling with the Gemara, that's what builds your mind. That's how it goes. And so forth and so on. Perhaps the most important example, which we don't really have to go into in detail now, just refer to it briefly. The most important example probably in Western society is marriage. In marriage, in the Torah world, Baruch Hashem, people know that marriage is something that has to be worked on. But in secular society, marriage is not surviving. Marriage is not surviving. As you well know, the divorce rate now is quoted in most Western societies, communities, as being over 50%. But in California, they quote the divorce rate now as being 60 to 70%. And that's a place where hardly anyone gets married in the first place. It's a place where you imagine that those who are getting married probably, you know, they must be unusually dedicated. Why? Because the relationship between a man and a woman has got two phases. The first, if you search for a name, the most appropriate name for the first phase is probably romance. And the second phase is love. And what's incredible is that in Hebrew we don't have a word for romance. We don't have a word for romance, we have a word for love. The word ahava is based on hav, it means to give. Love is where you give, like Rav Dessler explains at great length. You love where you give. That's why parents always love their children more than the children love the parents. Because the giving goes in that direction. Give. A mother's love is more intense than a father's because she gives life itself. She goes through it. You love where you give, not where you get. So we have a word for that, ahava. But romance? We don't have a word for that. What is romance? It's this illogical emotion. You know, in the secular, I mean, you wouldn't know anything about it. But in the secular world, you know, they tell me that it's written in the books over there that it's an illogical, you know, swirl of emotion. There's this person sitting in a room and this other person walks in. And as they look at each other, you know, there's a very interesting music that sort of wafts in on the breeze. And from the other side, it's the sound of bells, you know, that come in. And then you get this very strange asthmatic feeling. You know, well, what does that mean? No, I mean, nothing's been shared yet. Nothing's been given yet. You talk about love. It's not love. And they've got the chutzpah. Do you know what they call it? Do you know what the climax of romance is in the secular world? It's called love at first sight, which is the most intense paradox. By definition, there can't be love at first sight. You know, love is after 35 years of giving. Intensely, fearlessly, totally giving yourself. You can talk about love. But if you just take a look at somebody, there's really no giving. So we don't have a word for that. We don't even have a word for it. But Hashem gives it to you. You know why? Because He gives this swirl of emotion to people to get them involved in a relationship, to give them an inspiration and the thing starts with a flash of potential. That's what it is. It's an illusion, but it's real. But then He takes it away. You know when He takes it away? Exactly at the point where the young people think that it's going to last forever. The moment that they suddenly become clearly aware that this is going to be forever, pulls it away. Not after you get married, about 2.5 hours after you get married. Out there, that's what it is. Because, and if you read their books and their novels, again, you people wouldn't know about it. But if you read their books and novels, you see that's how it is. She's taking this Caribbean cruise. And as she comes up on deck, there standing at the rail is this creature in a starched white uniform. He's got a little cleft in his chin and a few blonde curls. And as she looks at him, this music, you know, drifts in over the waves and the bells and, you know, the asthma. Yeah. Those novels end 2 pages later. Because 35 years later, when she comes up on deck, it's like if she doesn't heave him overboard. If he's still there. No. See, a young man says to me, Rabbi, so look at his hands, his knuckles are white on the table. Says to me, you've got to help me, I've married the wrong woman. I said to him, why is she the wrong woman? I used to get dizzy. And I could not breathe properly. He said, look at, I couldn't breathe properly. Now I've been married for 2.5 months, breathing fine. He said, you haven't married the wrong girl. That's the way it's supposed to be. He doesn't know that. Why? Because they, you know what they've done? They've brought up a society and they've taught them romance and called it love. That's what they've done. They've built a picture in their society, in the media, in the literature. They've taught young people a thing that is in fact romance, and they've got the chutzpah to call it love. So these people think that they have love. And then what happens is 2 months later, when it's not there anymore, they think they've made a mistake, and then they go looking for it someplace else. Because nobody told them that life consists of two phases. Life consists of two phases. That's how it is. It's not meant to last. It can't last. Can't last. If you got asthma 3 months after getting married, you better see somebody professionally, because it's your chest. No. It's not your heart. It's your lungs. If you're still hearing bells 35 years later, you need medication, you know. It's not that's what it is, but they don't know that, you see. That's a tragedy. That's a tragedy. No one told them that there's the work that follows the uplift. They just want the uplift. Just a simple education, simple Torah education to point this out. Right? But it's unpopular, and it's not... it's a generation of quick fixes and a generation of the first phase, and that's what it is. But of course that's a tragedy, and it's bound to lead to failures in life. Let's look at Hanukkah briefly, yes, for a few minutes, and see if we can identify the application of this subject in Hanukkah. Let's do it this way. I'd like to share with you a Ramban. Ramban here, most sublime and beautiful explanation, most beautiful thing that the Ramban says, that okay, if this doesn't resonate within you, then there's no hope. This, the beauty of this is almost inexpressible, this particular insight that the Ramban opens for us. Where do we meet Hanukkah in the Torah? So, you know that the parasha of the menorah, right, the lighting of the menorah, like we light the menorah, the original menorah in the Mishkan, the sanctuary, the lighting of the menorah, that parasha follows immediately after the dedication, the Chanukah Samizbeach, the dedication of the Mizbeach, the altar, in the Mishkan that took place in the desert. Yes? You remember? What we have at the end of the parasha is the Nesiim bringing their gifts. They all bring their gifts, which are the moment of inauguration, if you like, the moment of ignition of the Mishkan, where it will enter its service as the focus among the Jewish people where Hashem's Shechinah will reside. They all 12, all the Nesiim, are bringing their detailed gifts. And the very next parasha is the parasha of Baha'u'llah, that Aaron will be given the job. Hashem will tell him that your work will be to light the lights. You will come in every morning, you'll find the western light burning miraculously, and then the other lights will have gone out, you'll fix them and clean them and relight them, etc. That is Aaron's work. We know that everything in Torah is significant. If these two are put next to each other, there must be a reason. So Rashi says the following thing. Rashi, bringing from Chazal, says the following thing. Stay carefully with me. It's most beautiful. Rashi says this. Aaron the priest, Aaron, was watching the Nesiim, the princes, bringing their gifts. And Chal Shadaito, it means his mind almost went. His mind weakened. He couldn't take it. Why? Because he had no part to play. He and his tribe, he and the Kohanim, had no part to play. Every Shevet, every tribe was bringing gifts that signified the beginning of the function of the Mishkan, right? This was the day of Chanukah Samizbeach. By the way, it was supposed to be Yes, 2 days ago. It was supposed to be the 25th of Kislev. Only Hashem put it off until Nisan, right? For a certain reason, because Nisan is the month in which Yitzchak was born. Why did Hashem want the Mishkan in the month in which Yitzchak was born? Yitzchak was avoided, no? He was the first korban, wasn't he? Yitzchak was the first korban, so the Mizbeach should have its moment of ignition. But Chafei Kislev is the time when it was ready. And then Hashem compensated Kislev by giving it our Chanukah later, centuries later. Hashem gave it, compensation. Listen to this carefully. The moment of finishing of the Mishkan, which is compensated by Chanukah later, listen to how that develops. Aaron is standing there, and he watches all these Nasim bringing their gifts. Aaron HaKohen is a man who lives entirely for Avodas Hashem. He is Avodas Hashem, that's all he is. And when he has no part to play in this, he cannot take it. His life is not worth living. It means, in a sense, he almost lost his mind. When Hashem saw his distress, Hashem said to him the following thing, Chayecha, which is the language of an oath. Hashem swore to him, Shelcha gedolah mishelahem, yours is greater than theirs. Why? Sha'ata meti v'zaneres, you, or Madlik, you are the one who will light the lights. It says Rashi, that's why the parsha of the menorah follows immediately after this parsha. He was standing there feeling terrible because he and the Kohanim had no share. So Hashem said, don't worry, and the very next mitzvah is, you light the menorah in the Mishkan, and that will be your... And then it's the Nisya Shvataito, his mind settled and he felt fine, he had his role, and everything was fine. That's what Rashi says. Beautiful, beautiful explanation of how that follows this, what he must have been thinking and how it's resolved. Comes along the Ramban and asks a whole list of questions on Rashi which seem absolutely unanswerable. And with paraphrasing slightly what the Ramban says, just to get a feel, he says the following thing. Stay with me carefully. First of all, why was Aaron feeling bad when he saw them bringing their gifts? Because he had no role to play? Had he forgotten that he was the whole Mishkan himself? Aaron's the high priest. He went in there, he offered all the sacrifices, he did all the work of the thing. He was the only human being who went in on Yom Kippur, Liflim, into the center of the Kodesh Kodoshim. He takes the Keteris in, the incense, he atones for the Jewish people. Is there anything in the Mishkan that's not Aaron? You hear the problem? Again, are you with me, everybody? He's standing there, right? A man who has virtually every role in the Mishkan is his. These people are bringing gifts and he feels terrible because he's got no role to play. What? And not only that, but they're bringing a one-time gift. His is a permanent role. He daily has all these things to do. And they're bringing a one-time gift at the moment of inauguration and he can't stand it. Why? Secondly, if that was the problem that he was feeling bad because he had no role, how did he feel better when Hashem told him to light the lights? It's another function. He'll light the menorah. Why does that make him feel better? The korbanos aren't enough. The keteris isn't enough. The Kodesh Kodashim, Yom Kippur is not enough. Hashem tells him, well, yes, you've got all that, but there's another one. You'll light the candle. You'll light the menorah. Then he feels okay. Why? Doesn't make any sense. Thirdly, I mean, there are many questions here. What did Hashem mean when he told him, yours will be greater than theirs? Yours will be greater than theirs. Why? Why is lighting the menorah greater than any other function than what they're doing? How do you judge these things? Why is it greater? Here's some of the questions that Ramban asks. And he answers the most inexpressibly beautiful answer. Stay with me carefully. Again, I'm paraphrasing and filling out a little bit just to make it clear. The Ramban says that what Aaron was feeling bad about is not the fact that he had no role to play. He had not forgotten that he had just about every role to play. What he craved was Chanukah HaMizbeach. What he was craving was the moment of beginning. That moment never comes again. He wanted to be there at the moment of dedication. Everything that comes after is only an expression of that moment of dedication. Everything that comes afterwards is only an expression, a manifestation, a bringing to the surface, a bringing out of that which happens. But the first moment is everything. Hakol helech achar harosh. Everything goes after the first moment. He wanted Chanukah. That's what he wanted. Chanukah samizbeach. Chinuch. You know what chinuch means? Education. That's what chinuch means. It's the starting off of the process of development. He wanted to be there at the beginning. That's what he wanted. He wanted to be there at the dedication, the inauguration, the ignition of what the Mishkan is. That will bring the Shekhinah in. That's what they were doing. His role is a role. He plays. He has many parts to play. But there's one priceless moment. There's one inexchangeable, priceless moment. And that's the moment when you bring those gifts and you do what you have to do, and Hashem comes to meet you. And that begins the process. Hashem couldn't pacify him with any other role at all. That's what he wanted. And therefore, when Hashem said that, saw that that's what he wanted, Chanukah's Mizbah, Hashem came to him and said, Chayecha, yours will be greater. And Hashem was not referring to the lighting of the menorah, says the Ramban. What Hashem said to him was, you know what's going to be your role? Many generations from now, out of you and your tribe will come Kohanim, who will rededicate the temple in the time of the Greeks, and they'll relight the lights. It's the lights of Chanukah that Hashem was offering him, and that's greater. You know why? Because the second light is greater than the first. The first light, when Hashem comes down to the Mishkan the first time, it's a free gift. Hashem comes in. The Nesim are bringing their things. They're in the desert. It's prophetic. Hashem is right there. Hashem is uplifting them, taking them out of Mitzrayim, carrying them on his hands. It's an incredible light. But what? You've been carried as a passenger. But when the Chashmonaim come, hundreds and hundreds of years later, after the Beis Hamikdash has been defiled and desecrated, and they will fight a war for years, and most of them will die, and they'll finally find one tiny little flask of oil. They'll rekindle that little flask of oil and will remain as a tiny flame in Jewish windows that will never go. The first one goes away. The Mishkan is not with us anymore. The Beis Hamikdash is not with us anymore. It gets taken away. But the second one is not going to get taken away. The second light that those Chashmonaim did, that burns in your window and it's going to keep burning on you until Mashiach comes. Never going to go. That's Chayecha. That's yours is greater than this. That's what he craved. You have to understand this. He wasn't craving a role. He was craving Chanukah Samizbech. He wanted to be there at the dedication. And Hashem said to him, you're going to get the second dedication. Not the first one that I'm doing. That these people are my passengers who bring in these gifts now and manifesting that. And you're going to be able to do the second one, which is the one where I leave your hands go and you walk. When the Jewish people are uplifted now, as I'm carrying them like on eagle's wings through the desert. Now that's the moment of the first light. But that's not where you'll become what you have to become. I'm going to take that away from you. This place is going to be destroyed. It's going to go into hiding. The Kalim will be buried. The menorah is going to be hidden deep underground. When the Romans and when they destroy the temple, they won't even find it. It'll be buried deep and the place will be lying in ruins. But then there'll come a time when your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, they will rededicate a defiled and a heap of ashes. They'll rededicate it and they'll reignite that Mizbah. And when that happens, that's going to be a light that's nothing compared to this. This is my light. It's infinite, this light. That will be a tiny little Bach Shemin. 8 days of a little flickering remnant of a miracle. And you know what will happen from that little light? The Jewish people will enact a mitzvah to light that light. And that light of the Chashmonim is going to burn in every Jewish window. And it's going to go year after year and century after century. And it's never going to go. You'll bring in the Messianic light again. Then he felt okay. When Hashem told him that, he understood that that would be his role. That's what would come out of him. That the malchus of the Chashmonaim would come out of him, and this is what they would achieve. Because the second light, and that's why the first light in the desert, the first light of those generations was prophecy, the written law, who can describe what it is, but Hashem writes it. But when Hashem takes it away and prophecy ends, that's when the oral law begins to be written. That's the Jewish people's contribution. That's what we write. That's human opinion, as it were. That's human contribution. That's our construction. That's where Torah really is. Torah is in the hearts and minds of the Jewish people. It's not the free gift that's given, that's just the spark, that's the inspiration. But it spawns and it generates, its flame generates the sparks that sear through history as the oral law, which is what the Jewish people build. And that's what it is. The second light is nothing compared to the first, but it's everything. It's everything. The second light is the light of ordeal and difficulty, but it's the light that lasts. And it's the one that finally closes the circle, that brings the experience of the beginning all the way through to the end. It's the light that makes meaningful the first light. The first light was only the challenge and the inspiration and the invitation, if you like, to achieve your own greatness. And it gets taken away with all the pain all the pain and sense of betrayal, perhaps sense of disappointment that means. But it's done so that you can build a second. Building of the second light, igniting that second light and keeping it burning, the result of that is a closeness and a oneness that cannot be matched. That is the secret. That is what Chanukah is. The first Chanukah was Kislev. That date back then, but the compensation of Kislev that never got that light is what it got now. What Kislev has now is the Chanukah that we experience. And therefore, instead, we should not look back in history and think about how great the miracles were as if we're nothing. You have to understand that those were incredibly great, and that's what made us, gave us the potential to be what we have to be. You have to understand, but now when you live in the darkness of history and all you have is this little flame that burns in your window that seems like almost nothing, but that's the real light. That's the light that we light, and that's the light that will be the one that will burn forever. God.